This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Much has been written and said about changes in the news media over recent years. What do those changes mean for you, the news consumer? A panel of media professionals will discuss this on Thursday, May 19th, at Western Michigan University's Fetzer Center. The community conversation called Breaking the News is sponsored by Intercom. Gretchen Johnson is the president of Intercom's board. She joins us in studio. Anna Clark is the Columbia Journalism Review's Midwest correspondent. She's based in Detroit. She'll be moderator for the panel discussion and joins us by phone. Thank you both for being here.
Glad to be here.
So, Gretchen, first of all, why does Intercom think this is a topic that's worthy of an hour and a half or so of discussion coming up on May 19th?
Well, our members are communication professionals, so we sit on both sides of the desk, both the media side and the news-making side of the desk. And we've seen coverage change over the last several decades, most dramatically maybe in the last 5 years or so. And since it's affecting us directly, we've been having the conversation quietly among our colleagues and peers, and we realize this is a conversation that really requires a bigger audience. It affects everyone in the community, everyone in the region, and it's something we want to explore at a deeper level.
Do you think the average person who reads a newspaper, watches television, listens to the radio, thinks of it that way yet? Or are they still maybe saying, oh, well, bad news for a newspaper, that means their bottom line is being hit. It means that some reporters might have to find other jobs or perhaps have to take pay cuts, et cetera.
I think they may have noticed that the coverage has changed. I don't know that they recognize how it's going to affect them directly. I know our research has shown that communities that are news-consuming communities, civically engaged communities, tend to consider their quality of life higher than perhaps those communities that aren't civically engaged and aren't real consumers. So there is a direct line there. I think the other factor is that people may not recognize that information they're getting online may not be vetted and may not be researched to the level that they're used to getting when they pick up the daily newspaper, for example, in the morning or turn on the local news channel.
And I wanted to give us some thoughts here where we stand right now and what are consumers getting and maybe not getting that they need from the news media.
Sure. I think a lot of what the changes that are happening in the media in Southwest Michigan are really in line with what's happening all over the country. I mean, as journalists, a lot of us are seeing that there's a real tectonic shift in the media industry right now. And truly, nobody knows exactly where it's going. You know, like people are trying to develop new business models. How do we support media institutions? How do we ensure that there's independent journalism happening in our communities? And this is important because we realize that there are, you know, quite literally lives on the line. You know, we've seen this in the Flint water crisis, how important it was that there was people in the media who were paying attention to it and helping to get the word out there about, like, what was happening there, you know? And you know, there have been a lot of conversations about how if there had been more journalists available, if there were more watchdogs out there, that maybe the news would have broken sooner even. I think for, like, news consumers, readers, listeners of local news, I think the most important thing is to be, like, looking for is kind of a diversity of options. And like Gretchen said, you know, to make sure that, like, these sources have some independence about them, that they have some process for vetting their news, you know. Things are moving much more quickly. In a lot of ways, that's wonderful. But it is, I think, and this is what I kind of hope to talk about with the great group we're going to have together at this panel, is how we're, you know, ensuring the vetting process is intact in the way that it's meant to be, even as we're speeding things up and experimenting with new models for it to make journalism sustainable.
Well, has anyone yet developed what seems to be the next potential way to make journalism, if not profitable, at least a sustainable enterprise that can afford to pay people a living wage to, you know, investigate and to report on what's happening in their community?
Well, people are experimenting, and there's a lot of, and this is at the Columbia Journalism Review, we write a lot about this, kind of like paying attention to see what works. And some things that seem to be gathering some steam is events, a live event. A lot of, like, news institutions, including legacy ones like the Detroit Free Press, Detroit News, are finding that they're able to generate revenue by having like events that feature some of their journalists there, or, you know, kind of like a tour of restaurants, or, you know, they do like Michigan Radio, who's also going to be on the panel, has like an Issues and Ale regular event, you know, kind of bring people together to talk about the news. And I think that's wonderful because it generates community. It helps amplify the news coverage, make sure that, like, helps these stories, like, you know, extend their reach. But again, like, it's something to sort of, like, think about, too, right? Like, if you're having an event at a local restaurant, does that impact how that news outlet reviews that restaurant, for example? You know what I mean?
What if you find out that after you're holding that event, or maybe even worse, 2 days before your event is supposed to be there, you find out that they've been violating safety codes and that sort of thing?
It's a process, right? Like I think the thing we're at now is, like, because the news business is changing so much, we have to be thoughtful about how we are changing how we do the news, how we disclose conflicts of interest, for example, to make sure that even as we are evolving, which is important, you know, that we are innovating, that we are taking advantage of new technology, new ways to reach readers and audiences, being efficient, all that stuff's important. But I think we do got to make sure that we're not losing some of the standards that came into being for a reason, and it's so that we can build credibility with news audience, whether we've been serving the community for a very long time or whether we're a new startup trying to build our audience. Either way, I think, like, for readers and listeners and viewers of news media, people want to know that they can trust where the reporters are coming from, because they know that those reporters will be honest about, like, how this came to be. You know, they can trust that process.
Well, there's another question, I suppose, for consumers, and Gretchen or Anna, I think either one of you might be able to address this, and that is the news consumer willing to pay something, a subscription? I mean, in the old days, everyone kind of accepted that you would pay a subscription to have a newspaper delivered to your home, or if you wanted to buy it at the newsstand, you would put your money down there. Well, now a lot of that content is available online. And if you've, I suppose you could say, well, you got to pay to have internet connection, but you can also find places where you can get it for free. You're paying in some way. But, you know, does quality news perhaps come with a price? And do consumers have to think about that as they're out there trying to figure out what they're going to read, watch, and listen to? Gretchen, you want to go first?
Sure. Actually, some of our research has found that people are willing to pay for news. So Bloomberg reported in their quick take that, well, in many countries, the people who pay for access to news has been holding steady at about 10%. The majority of those are actually paying for news specifically. So people are willing to pay for news. There are models, New York Times, Washington Post, who have done this quite successfully. I've talked to many people here in our community who have said, I would pay for more daily news. The other side of that argument is, does that create a divide? If you look at the haves and have-nots, for example, does that mean that people who are economically challenged and can't afford to pay for news don't get the same access? So you're creating a divide there that I think is an issue that we need to consider.
You're allowing people who are better off to be better informed than would be the case if things are largely available to the public, which, at least, again, if you can get to an internet connection now, you can find out a lot of stuff. Anna, what about the idea of subscriptions? Is there a way to make this profitable or at least make it more sustainable that would have consumers paying in some way for the news they get?
Yeah, I think this is, like, where there is a lot of experimentation happening. And it's true that there is, the New York Times especially has had, you know, success with digital subscriptions, digital subscriptions bundled with print. You know, they've had a success with, you know, and inviting people to pay for what they offer. And that's wonderful. And so I think it set a standard that I think a lot of other news outlets, especially ones with national reach, are, you know, kind of modeling. I think that is a harder case to make for outlets that aren't the New York Times. But I think there are other models for how people can pay for their news. And I agree that, like, a lot of people are willing. And one of them is, frankly, the public radio model, donations, right? Or memberships, or, you know, different ways where you, like, sort of, like, you offer the content freely, but you also invite people to buy in, you know, when they see the worth of it. And I think a lot of people are doing that, you know, through their independent news outlets and things like that. And that's great. Bridge Magazine, which is going to be with us at the panel, they have an unusual model in that they sort of have like a patron. They basically have like an endowment right now, you know, and they're kind of like housed within a nonprofit. And so they have this like sort of sustainable, you know, long-term support, which is, you know, kind of the envy of a lot of other news outlets right now. But that's made that possible for them to offer their work for free. But they partner a lot with other local news outlets, too. So, I mean, it's the point is there's a lot of diversity happening right now. I think with the unfortunate nature of a lot of, you know, beloved news outlets closing or shrinking, I think folks are beginning to realize what's at stake when that happens, how there isn't, that isn't easily replicated, that journalism is journalism, and it's not the same thing as just sort of content, I guess, on a website. And I think, you know, when people realize that it's worth, unfortunately, sometimes in its absence, I think that kind of like inspires a lot of people to buy in and support the journalism of the future.
You mentioned Bridge. They do actually have, though, a request for donations. So they're kind of maybe a hybrid of a couple different approaches when it comes to trying to make their model work.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I actually did write an article about them for the Columbia Journalism Review because they're so interesting. First of all, I think they do a lot of wonderful work, but they're an online news startup. And usually when you hear that phrase, you think of like young people, millennials, people just starting out. You know,
someone in their basement.
Tech savvy. Yeah, exactly. But actually, it's like staffed almost entirely by veteran newspaper reporters. Its median age is a lot higher than what you'd imagine most online startups being. And while it has this, like, they're putting like lots of wonderful reporting on their website, you know, I don't think, you know, you would argue that it's like, it's not as like, it's, it doesn't have as much, you know, tech shine, I think, as a lot of other online news startups do. And they do great work. And I think that's just like, it's just interesting as like another alternative. I think what a lot of journalists, editors, publishers, things that people are looking out for right now are just, what are our choices, you know? Like, things are changing. What's possible right now to do the work we do? And you talk about things that give us hope, too. Like, I mean, one thing that gives me hope is that there are so many people who are rooted in this, you know? That journalism is truly their vocation. And even as things are changing, and that it's often scary and often very sad, this is still worth doing. And people are dug in, and I'm excited to see what we all create together.
Gretchen, you've noted that in Kalamazoo, there's been a couple of different developments since the Kalamazoo Gazette announced its most recent changes. Among those, that the Arts Council of Greater Kalamazoo has been thinking about establishing a new sort of dedicated publication just for the arts. Western Michigan University's athletic department told everybody, hey, we've got a website of our own that will tell you who won and who lost and give you the schedule and give you some insights and those sort of things. I suppose the question that comes up when a journalist reads that is, what about independence? What about having a little distance between you and the athletic department, a little distance between the reporter and the Arts Council in terms of giving a completely fair and honest report to the listeners, readers, and viewers?
Well, and that's an interesting question. One of the conversations that we've had is, what actually is news? We spoke with one of the local editors who'd made a decision to decrease their coverage, and the response we got was, arts and entertainment, for example, is a lot of promotion. So is that hard news? Well, obviously it's not hard news. Is it news? If you look at a community, arts and entertainment in particular has been called a catalyzer of economic development. Consider what it means, and keep in mind we're talking about this in the middle of the Gilmore Keyboard Festival.
Yeah, right.
The jobs that it provides, the trickle-on economy from retail establishments, ticket sales, and even the sense of place that it gives a community. Kalamazoo, I believe, has more per capita theater than any other community in Michigan. Arts and entertainment is really integral to how we view ourselves as a community. So the decision to decrease coverage of that, what does that mean to the consumer? What does that mean to us as a community? What effect is that going to have long term?
When you raise the issue, though, of who is a journalist or what is a news organization or where does news actually come from, there are some, I guess for lack of a better term, advocacy groups out there who have hired investigative journalists, many of whom lost their jobs at newspapers. And they're going out and finding some of the things. That was the ACLU hired an investigative reporter who helped bring some of the Flint water crisis to light. Anna, I guess I'm wondering, you know, is there a potential there to fill some of the void when people maybe go out and hire journalists at some of these groups, which, again, need to be covered as well by the news media? But are they also maybe helping to hold public officials' feet to the fire in some way?
I'm glad you mentioned the ACLU, because that's really interesting. The ACLU of Michigan is the only chapter in the country that had an investigative reporter. It was sort of an experiment funded by the Ford Foundation. And Kirk Guyette, a veteran of most notably Metro Times, the Detroit Alternative Weekly, was hired. And his task was, because it was such an unprecedented position, his task was to sort of cover emergency management in Michigan, and not to do it in a way that was essentially research for, like, ACLU's other work, but just to report on it. And I think, exactly what you're saying, to kind of help, fill perhaps a void. And that's what led him to the Flint water crisis, because Flint, of course, was under emergency management. And as I think anyone will tell you, like, thank God for him, like, he was one of the people, like, a lot of us were aware that there was, like, complaints about the water, but weren't quite sure what was going on. He was somebody who was on the ground very early on and was pressing it as something to take seriously, truly before anyone. And he got, like, a big scoop with a leaked memo from the Environmental Protection Agency. He published it on the ACLU's, website. He got it out there, but felt like it needed to get more readership because it's too important to let go. And he actually, like, passed that memo on to Michigan Radio so they could help broadcast it. And this is what sort of lead to a real change and newfound pressure on the state to respond more seriously to this. And anyway, so I think, like, the ACLU model is, I think we're awfully lucky in Michigan to have been the chapter that had the investigative reporter there. I think, again, like, it also, like, brings it back to, like, what, when we, like, house journalism in different institutions, what changes? What about the process changes, I think it's just something to think about, like, what are the limits of advocacy journalism? What is possible with it? And I think, thinking about, like, recalibrating, I guess, our ground rules, even as, like, journalism happens in different places, is something I think worth doing so that we, can be as transparent as possible with the communities we serve.
I wonder if what you just brought up there, though, the idea of the ACLU sort of doing some of the groundwork and then calling up our public radio colleagues at Michigan Radio and saying, hey, look, take a look at this memo. Does this maybe highlight the need for collaboration? Those of us who are on this side of the microphone often think we're in competition, but if we're sort of working collaboratively at the end of the day, do we maybe have to keep in mind that the most important thing is the public has a right to know and that, whoever gets the scoop is sort of secondary to that?
I think the way you put that is really beautiful, because it is what's true. And it is, I'm sure, at the heart of a lot of collaborations that are happening right now. And there's a great number of them. One of them won the Pulitzer Prize. There was the Marshall Project, which is only a little more than a year old, I think, online publication co-founded by the former executive editor of the New York Times, focusing on the criminal justice system. They partnered with ProPublica, a nonprofit news outlet, also publishes online, but designed to collaborate with traditional news outlets. The two of them worked together on a story called An Unbelievable Story of Rape. It was extraordinary. It was an amazing story, and they just won a Pulitzer Prize for it. I think keeping our focus on, like, why we're doing what we're doing is key. And I think especially when a lot of news outlets are thinned out or have limited capacity for whatever reason, having the humility to, like, reach out to someone else and say, hey, I can do this really well. I know you can do that other thing really well. Together, we can figure out a way to work together. We're going to be able to, like, do something wonderful and meaningful for our communities. I think that's great. I mean, I think there's a lot to learn about how to do a collaboration well, but other than that, I think it's a great model.
Well, before we wrap it up, let me give you both a chance to maybe talk about what you'd like to see going forward for the media, for groups that work with the media. I'll start with you, Gretchen.
Well, my personal experience over the last decade, I have worked with clients who are in areas like workforce development, community growth, placemaking. I've also worked on a number of both individual candidate campaigns and issue-related campaigns. And I think the conversation around what's happening in a real and honest way has to continue. I think journalists at the local level are absolutely essential to a community's future, to our growth and vitality. And I hope that one of the things that at least comes out of this conversation that we're having in a few weeks is how working together on both sides of the desk, the journalists, the politicians, the for-profit and nonprofit organizations that are looking to get their message out, that we find some solutions that are sustainable and will benefit all of us.
And Anna?
I think the movie Spotlight came out just a few months ago about the Boston Globe crucial investigation of the Catholic Church's sex abuse scandal in 2001, 2002. And it's gotten an amazing response. And I think...
Including the Academy Award for Best Picture.
Absolutely. And I think what's something that was so heartening about that, besides it just being a wonderful movie, well told, is that I think it helps tell the story of how journalism happens when it's working right to people who are outside journalism, but who know that they need it and who know that they depend on it, who are rooting up for their like local institutions to thrive. And I think I love that as like a kind of buoy going forward, you know, like we are in a moment of great change. Some of that change is wonderful. I think a lot of times it's like the narrative kind of goes towards journalism crashing and burning. I don't think that's true at all. I think there's a lot of wonderful journalism happening and exciting new models, but it is changing. And some of it is really difficult and hard. And there are things we need to push back on. I really want to see people who have the, you know, interest and ability to tell true stories about their communities, to find facts that would not be revealed any other way. I want to be able to, I think I want to be able to support them in our communities. I want to help make it possible for them to do the work that they do, whether it's as crucial of an investigation as Boston Globe or day-to-day arts coverage, which is important, you know, because the cultural life of our communities are important. And I feel very curious right now, I guess, talking to the folks on the panel, talking to journalists who have been in it a long time or just, you know, getting in it now about what they think and how we can do it. Because right now, what I think we need is, most of all, is good ideas. And I think we need people to put a stake in it. Like, you know, like get rooted in it. Like if you're a reader, if you're a listener, if you depend on local media, if you care about it, maybe being willing to chip in, you know, because I think we're all in this together as we figure out where we're going next.
Anna Clark and Gretchen Johnson, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Gretchen Johnson is president of the board for Intercom, which is hosting a panel discussion and community conversation called Breaking the News on Thursday, May 19th at Western Michigan University's Fetzer Center. She joined us in studio. Anna Clark is the Columbia Journalism Review's Midwest correspondent. She's based in Detroit. She'll be the moderator for the panel discussion and joined us by phone. You can find more details about the event called Breaking the News through a link at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.